Chapter 26. A red cap has been seen at the windows more than once, which people take to be the ghost of the body buried there. Once upon a time, three soldiers took shelter in the building for the night, and rummaged it from top to bottom, when they found old Father Red Cap astride of a cider barrel in the cellar, with a jug in one hand, and a goblet in the other. He offered them a drink out of his goblet, but just as one of the soldiers was putting it to his mouth, whew! A flash of fire blazed through the cellar, blinded every mother's son of them for several minutes, and when they recovered their eyesight, jug, goblet, and red cap had vanished, and nothing but the empty cider barrel remained. Here the half-pay officer, who was growing very muzzy and sleepy, and nodding over his liquor, with half-extinguished eye, suddenly gleamed up like an expiring rushlight. "That's all fudge," said he, as Peachy finished his last story. "Well, I don't vouch for the truth of it myself," said Peachy Prow, "though all the world knows that there's something strange about that house and grounds. But as to the story of Mud Sam, I believe it just as well as if it had happened to myself." The deep interest taken in this conversation by the company had made them unconscious of the uproar abroad among the elements, when suddenly they were electrified by a tremendous clap of thunder. A lumbering crash followed instantaneously, shaking the building to its very foundation. All started from their seats, imagining it the shock of an earthquake, or that old Father Red Cap was coming among them in all his terrors. They listened for a moment, but only heard the rain pelting against the windows, and the wind howling among the trees. The explosion was soon explained by the apparition of an old Negro's bald head thrust in at the door, his white goggle eyes contrasting with his jetty pole, which was wet with rain, and shone like a bottle. In a jargon, but half intelligible, he announced that the kitchen chimney had been struck with lightning. A sullen pause of the storm, which now rose and sank in gusts, produced a momentary stillness. In this interval the report of a musket was heard, and a long shout, almost like a yell, resounded from the shores. Everyone crowded to the window. Another musket shot was heard, and another long shout, mingled wildly with a rising blast of wind. It seemed as if the cry came up from the bosom of the waters, for though incessant flashes of lightning spread a light about the shore, no one was to be seen. Suddenly the window of the room overhead was opened, and a loud halloo uttered by the mysterious stranger. Several hailings passed from one party to the other, but in a language which none of the company in the barroom could understand, and presently they heard the window closed, and a great noise overhead, as if all the furniture were pulled and hauled about the room. The Negro servant was summoned, and shortly afterwards was seen assisting the veteran to lug the ponderous sea chest downstairs. The landlord was in amazement. "Hat, you are not going on the water in such a storm?" "Storm," said the other scornfully, "do you call such a sputter of weather a storm? You'll get drenched to the skin, you'll catch your death," said Peachy Prow affectionately. "Thunder and lightning," exclaimed the veteran. "Don't preach about weather to a man that has cruised in whirlwinds and tornadoes." The obsequious Peachy was again struck dumb. The voice from the water was heard once more in a tone of impatience. The bystanders stared with redoubled awe at this man of storms, who seemed to have come up out of the deep, and to be summoned back to it again. As, with the assistance of the Negro, he slowly bore his ponderous sea chest toward the shore, they eyed it with a superstitious feeling, half doubting whether he were not really about to embark upon it, and launch forth upon the wild waves. They followed him at a distance with a lantern. "Dose one, the light," roared the hoarse voice from the water. "Oh, one wants light here." "One, extinguish." "Thunder and lightning," exclaimed the veteran, turning short upon them. "Back to the house with you." Wolford and his companions shrank back in dismay. Still their curiosity would not allow them entirely to withdraw. A long sheet of lightning now flickered across the waves, and discovered a boat, filled with men, just under a rocky point, rising and sinking with the heaving surges, and swashing the waters at every heave. It was with difficulty held to the rocks by a boat hook, for the current rushed furiously round the point. The veteran hoisted one end of the lumbering sea chest on the gunwale of the boat, and seized the handle at the other end to lift it in. When the motion propelled the boat from the shore, the chest slipped off from the gunwale, and, sinking into the waves, pulled the veteran headlong after it. A loud shriek was uttered by all on shore, and a volley of execrations by those on board, but boat and man were hurried away by the rushing swiftness of the tide. A pitchy darkness succeeded. Wolfert Webber, indeed, fancied that he distinguished a cry for help, and that he beheld the drowning man beckoning for assistance. But when the lightning again gleamed along the water, all was void. Neither man nor boat was to be seen, nothing but the dashing and weltering of the waves as they hurried past. The company returned to the tavern, to await the subsiding of the storm. They resumed their seats and gazed on each other with dismay. The whole transaction had not occupied 5 minutes, and not a dozen words had been spoken. When they looked at the oaken chair, they could scarcely realize the fact that the strange being who had so lately tenanted it, full of life and Herculean vigor, should already be a corpse. There was the very glass he had just drunk from. There lay the ashes from the pipe which he had smoked, as it were, with his last breath. As the worthy burghers pondered on these things, they felt a terrible conviction of the uncertainty of existence, and each felt as if the ground on which he stood was rendered less stable by his awful example. As, however, the most of the company were possessed of that valuable philosophy which enables a man to bear up with fortitude against the misfortunes of his neighbors, they soon managed to console themselves for the tragic end of the veteran. The landlord was particularly happy that the poor dear man had paid his reckoning before he went, and made a kind of farewell speech on the occasion. "He came," said he, "in a storm, and he went in a storm. He came in the night, and he went in the night. He came nobody knows whence, and he has gone nobody knows where. For aught I know, he has gone to sea once more on his chest, and may land to bother some people on the other side of the world. Though it's a thousand pities," added he, "if he has gone to Davy Jones' one locker, that he had not left his own locker, too, behind him. 1. Davy Jones is the spirit of the sea, or the sea devil, and Davy Jones' locker is the bottom of the ocean. Hence, gone to Davy Jones' locker signifies eat and buried in the sea. 2. Chest. His locker. St. Nicholas preserve us," cried Peachy Prawl. "He not have had that sea chest in the house for any money. I'll warrant he'd come racketing after it at nights, and making a haunted house of the inn. And as to his going to sea in his chest, I recollect what happened to Skipper Onderdink's ship on his voyage from Amsterdam. The boatswain died during a storm, so they wrapped him up in a sheet, and put him in his own sea chest, and threw him overboard. But they neglected, in their hurry-scurry, to say prayers over him, and the storm raged and roared louder than ever, and they saw the dead man seated in his chest, with his shroud for a sail, coming hard after the ship, and the sea breaking before him in great sprays like fire. And there they kept scudding day after day and night after night, expecting every moment to go to wreck. And every night they saw the dead boatswain in his sea chest trying to get up with them, and they heard his whistle above the blasts of wind, and he seemed to send great seas, mountain high, after them that would have swamped the ship, if they had not put up the deadlights. And so it went on till they lost sight of him in the fogs off Newfoundland, and supposed he had veered ship, and stood for Dead Man's Isle. 1. So much for burying a man at sea without saying prayers over him. 1. Probably Deadman's Point, a small island near Deadman's Bay, off the eastern coast of Newfoundland. The thunder gust which had hitherto detained the company was now at an end. The cuckoo clock in the hall told midnight. Everyone pressed to depart, for seldom was such a late hour of the night trespassed on by these quiet burghers. As they sallied forth, they found the heavens once more serene. The storm which had lately obscured them had rolled away, and lay piled up in fleecy masses on the horizon, lighted up by the bright crescent of the moon, which looked like a little silver lamp hung up in a palace of clouds. The dismal occurrence of the night, and the dismal narrations they had made, had left a superstitious feeling in every mind. They cast a fearful glance at the spot where the buccaneer had disappeared, almost expecting to see him sailing on his chest in the cool moonshine. The trembling rays glittered along the waters, but all was placid, and the current dimpled over the spot where he had gone down. The party huddled together in a little crowd as they repaired homeward, particularly when they passed a lonely field where a man had been murdered, and even the sexton, who had to complete his journey alone, though accustomed, one would think, to ghosts and goblins, went a long way round, rather than pass by his own churchyard. Wolfert Webber had now carried home a fresh stock of stories and notions to ruminate upon. These accounts of pots of money and Spanish treasures, buried here and there, and everywhere about the rocks and bays of these wild shores, made him almost dizzy. "Blessed Saint Nicholas," ejaculated he, half aloud, "is it not possible to come upon one of these golden hoards, and to make oneself rich in a twinkling? How hard that I must go on, delving and delving, day in and day out, merely to make a morsel of bread, when one lucky stroke of a spade might enable me to ride in my carriage for the rest of my life." As he turned over in his thoughts all that had been told of the singular adventure of the negro fisherman, his imagination gave a totally different complexion, one, to the tale. He saw in the gang of red caps nothing but a crew of pirates burying their spoils, and his cupidity was once more awakened by the possibility of at length getting on the traces of some of this lurking wealth. Indeed, his infected fancy tinged everything with gold. He felt like the greedy inhabitant of Baghdad, when his eyes had been greased with the magic ointment of the dervish, that gave him to see all the treasures of the earth. 2. Caskets of buried jewels, chests of ingots, and barrels of outlandish coins seemed to court him from their concealments, and supplicate him to relieve them from their untimely graves. 1. Aspect. 2. See story of the blind man, Baba Abdallah, in Arabian Nights Entertainment. An inhabitant of Baghdad, Asiatic Turkey, meets with a dervish, or Turkish monk, who presents him with a vast treasure, and with a box of magic ointment, which, applied to the left eye, enables one to see the treasures in the bosom of the earth, but on touching the right eye, causes blindness. Having applied it to the left eye with the result predicted, he uses it on his right eye, in the hope that still greater treasures may be revealed, and immediately becomes blind. On making private inquiries about the ground said to be haunted by Feather Red Cap, he was more and more confirmed in his surmise. He learned that the place had several times been visited by experienced money diggers who had heard Black Sam's story, though none of them had met with success. On the contrary, they had always been dogged with ill luck of some kind or other, in consequence, as Wolfert concluded, of not going to work at the proper time, and with the proper ceremonials. The last attempt had been made by Cobus Quickenbos, who dug for a whole night, and met with incredible difficulty, for as fast as he threw one shovel full of earth out of the hole, two were thrown in by invisible hands. He succeeded so far, however, as to uncover an iron chest, when there was a terrible roaring, ramping, and raging of uncouth figures about the hole, and at length a shower of blows, dealt by invisible cudgels, fairly belabored him off of the forbidden ground. This Cobus Quickenbos had declared on his deathbed, so that there could not be any doubt of it. He was a man that had devoted many years of his life to money digging, and it was thought would have ultimately succeeded had he not died recently of a brain fever in the almshouse. Wolfert Webber was now in a worry of trepidation and impatience, fearful lest some rival adventurer should get a scent of the buried gold. He determined privately to seek out the black fisherman, and get him to serve as guide to the place where he had witnessed the mysterious scene of interment. Sam was easily found, for he was one of those old habitual beings that live about a neighborhood until they wear themselves a place in the public mind and become, in a manner, public characters. There was not an unlucky urchin about town that did not know Sam the fisherman and think that he had a right to play his tricks upon the old Negro. Sam had led an amphibious life for more than half a century about the shores of the bay and the fishing grounds of the Sound. He passed the greater part of his time on and in the water, particularly about Hell Gate, and might have been taken, in bad weather, for one of the hobgoblins that used to haunt that strait. There would he be seen, at all times and in all weathers, sometimes in his skiff, anchored among the eddies, or prowling like a shark about some wreck, where the fish are supposed to be most abundant, sometimes seated on a rock from hour to hour, looking, in the mist and drizzle, like a solitary heron watching for its prey. He was well acquainted with every hole and corner of the Sound, from the wall about one, to Hell Gate, and from Hell Gate unto the Devil's Stepping Stones, and it was even affirmed that he knew all the fish in the river by their Christian names. 1. A bay of the East River, on which the Brooklyn Navy Yard is situated. Wolfert found him at his cabin, which was not much larger than a tolerable doghouse. It was rudely constructed of fragments of wrecks and driftwood, and built on the rocky shore at the foot of the old fort, just about what at present forms the point of the battery. 1. A very ancient and fish-like smell, 2. Pervaded the place. Oars, paddles, and fishing rods were leaning against the wall of the fort, a net was spread on the sand to dry, a skiff was drawn upon the beach, and at the door of his cabin was Mud Sam himself, indulging in the true Negro luxury of sleeping in the sunshine. 1. The southern extremity of New York City. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.